Scientific Problems for Scientism by Robert C. Newman. An abstract of this talk. The idea that this world is all there is, that there's no supernatural, has had a profound effect on modern, especially Western society. Here we examine a number of scientific problems facing this worldview, namely its inability to predict the future, its aversion to real evidence of discontinuity in nature, its inability to explain the evidence of a mind behind the universe, evidence that the universe is not eternal, and the peculiar phenomena of quantum reality, which point to some sort of omnipresence. This audio for this PowerPoint is a PowerPoint version of a paper by the same title, published in the journal Presbyterion, Presbyterion, in the fall issue of 1995. So see that paper for references and further details. When I use the term scientism here, it's one of several terms for a particular worldview. Scientism stresses the idea that science is the only valid way of knowing, which is part of this view. Another alternative term for the view is materialism, that everything that exists is matter or matter energy. Another term is naturalism, that everything is nature, there is no supernatural. Another term is evolutionism. All things have developed by unguided natural processes, that no God has intervened miraculously to make things the way they are. Scientism has had a huge influence in a number of fields. In the area of liberal biblical criticism, it lies behind the desire to explain the Bible without recourse to miracles. In Darwinian evolution, scientism lies behind the idea of explaining nature without divine intervention. In Marxism, explaining history and society by means of economics. In Freudianism, explaining mankind without recourse to a soul or spirit. And yet scientism, as influential as it has been in those various areas, faces some big scientific problems. We're going to categorize these problems under the following headings: prediction, continuity, mindlessness, eternality, and locality. Let's have a look. Prediction. Back early in the 1800s, the famed French mathematician Pierre-Simon Laplace had a brief contact with Napoleon, and Napoleon responded to Laplace's theory for the origin of the Earth and the solar system by asking Laplace what place God had in all of this. And Laplace responded, "I have no need of that hypothesis." That is the idea here. Laplace believed that one could calculate the entire future in principle of the universe by knowing the position and velocity of all of its particles at one time. So we might call that the Laplacian program. Calculate the entire future of the universe by knowing the position and velocity of all of its particles at one time. In principle, that seemed something that could be done at Laplace's time. Newtonian physics ruled the roost, and it seemed that if you could know the position and velocity of each of the particles, there was nothing else to take into account, and you could, in principle, do the calculation. Laplace was well aware that it would be a huge calculation, all of that. Well, suppose we ask ourselves, yes, how big a problem is it? How much computing power would you need to do this? We have reason to believe that inside our universe, let's say anyway, within the Hubble sphere, the distance that light has traveled since the Big Bang would be the radius of the sphere, that there are about 10 to the 80th particles. Each of these particles exerts one or more forces on nearly all the other particles. With that in view, then figuring out all of the forces involved, it soon becomes apparent that it would be more economical to build a parallel universe as a model. But then to predict the future, you would need to make sure you had all of the particles in this parallel universe at some particular location and velocity that corresponded to some point in the history of our universe and then let it run. And of course, if you're talking about predicting, you would actually have to have it run faster than our universe does in order to get ahead. This involves giving each particle its proper position and velocity, and that runs us immediately into a problem that Laplace knew nothing about. That's the problem of quantum uncertainty. We now know that it is not possible for us inside the universe to give a particle an exact position and velocity. At least it's not possible for us to determine the exact position and velocity of any single particle in our universe. We obviously can, in principle, assign a position and velocity for each particle in some imagined universe. But trying to figure out where our universe is, you run into this problem of quantum uncertainty. You run into another problem also that has been discovered more recently in connection with chaos theory. It's what we call the butterfly effect, and that is that for systems that are described by certain types of differential equations that have nonlinear elements to them, that no matter how accurately you know a starting position of something, two solutions can be infinitesimally close at one point in time, but because these nonlinear effects, they will diverge from each other by very large amounts after even a moderate amount of time. This has been called the butterfly effect because of an application of this to doing meteorology, doing weather prediction. It was discovered early on in the computer age that doing weather predictions, you've got arbitrarily large differences of two solutions, even though they were very close to one another earlier on. And this came to be captured by someone as the problem of not knowing or the effect of a butterfly flapping its wings in China might a few weeks later produce a very big difference in the weather in the United States. And so the name, the butterfly effect. When we think over all these things, we see that humans inside our universe are just not able to predict the future. It's too big a problem, and it involves these two uncertainties that we cannot handle. And the upshot is that the Laplacian program of predicting the future, even in principle, is dead. Contrast this to the Christian worldview. In the Christian worldview, God alone knows the future. And that fits with where we are here anyway. We don't know the future. In the Christian worldview, God can intervene. And according to the Christian worldview, he surely has. And he can answer prayer. And he can fulfill prophecy. And so we have a very different picture of our world. We move to the second problem, that of continuity. Scientism has an antagonism for and fear of gaps or singularities in nature. This was part of Darwin's program, was to devise a theory of the history of life so that there would be no discontinuities in biology if the history of life is taken into account. Just these small changes and the ones that worked well selected for survival, if you like. This antagonism for and fear of gaps and singularities in nature, I think, explains part of the reaction of biologists to the biologist Goldschmidt in the 1940s when he had his hopeful monster model in which he predicted that the history of life on Earth needed to have large mutations that produced big jumps in the structure of living things to explain the fossil record. And they were not about to go that way. There's been a slightly milder reaction of biologists in the 70s to the punctuated equilibrium model of Gould and others, but in that we see this particular problem. Well, problems with continuity? As Gould himself pointed out, the trade secret of paleontology is that there are gaps in the fossil record. There are over 200 million fossils cataloged in museums, and thinking of the kind of picture that you can put together with 200 million pixels, we ought not to have big gaps in the fossil record. if there weren't any. And when you think about how to get from one major body plan to another major body plan, scientistic, a materialistic view of reality has nothing but a random walk to carry you from one design to one rather different design, but all of that would leave behind all kinds of transitional fossils in the fossil record. The shape of the fossil record is not what a Darwinian model would expect either. A Darwinian model would propose a fossil record that starts with basically one sort of living thing, and gradually the sort diverges into slightly more diverse varieties, and these diverge into more diverse varieties such until you finally get, last of all, the most divergent sorts of things, different body plans and things of that sort. But you don't see that in a fossil record. What you see is the main body plans show up already at the Cambrian explosion about 550 million years ago, and nothing of that sort has shown up since. Instead of one tree, it looks like you've got a bunch of separated bushes. Conclusions on continuity? Are we looking at a god of the gaps, as opponents of theism suggest, that's brought in to explain how you get across these gaps? Or are we looking at a natural law of the gaps, which is what the naturalists would want to suggest? Are we looking at lack of evidence for continuity, or are we looking at evidence for lack of continuity? And my suggestion would be that the problem of the shape of the fossil record, the problem of relative lack of transitional forms, does in fact provide positive evidence that we're not looking at continuity here. And if so, these discontinuities point beyond mere natural law. Come to the third problem of scientism, and that's mindlessness. According to scientism, minds only arise by evolution in what was hitherto a mindless universe, and presumably the universe is still a mindless universe on the scale of an overarching mind behind it all. Darwin's work then was hailed as destroying Paley's arguments from design to a designer. As Richard Dawkins pointed out, Darwin made it possible for one to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. In the scientism model, design is only apparent. It's not real. It's something, an appearance of design that is produced by natural selection. But design appears in inanimate nature also. And we've seen that recently in the whole thing over the fine-tuning of the basic forces of the universe and the very striking features of our environment here on Earth. Fine-tuning in the basic forces, we've sketched in other PowerPoint talks here on our website, but I point out here that the basic forces of the universe that we know of, the strong interaction, the weak interaction, gravitation, electromagnetism, the strong interaction is tuned to plus or minus 5%. The weak interaction is tuned to a few percent. Gravity and cosmic expansion are tuned to one part in 10 to the 60. Electromagnetism, the charges balance to better than one part in 10 to the 40. Enormous fine-tuning in the universe. If these things were not within those ranges, we would not have any life in our universe. Some have attempted to explain that away by suggesting that, in fact, there are many, many universes in reality. Getting into the question of how you define universes, which we'll not worry about here, each with different basic forces or different size basic forces, and only in a very few of these are things right for life. Well, it may be so, but the evidence for it is zero at the moment, and it certainly is not science to make a huge hypothesis like that without any evidence for it. Besides that, we have the evidence of a designed Earth. Its rotation period is just where it needs to be for life. Its distance from the sun, the thickness of our crust, the atmosphere, etc. By the way, these are discussed in more detail in our PowerPoint talk entitled Cosmos and Contact. The atmosphere of our Earth having the right amount of oxygen. The size of our moon, which is the largest moon compared to its planetary size in our whole solar system. The size of Jupiter, having a big Jupiter-sized planet out beyond ours in a fairly circular orbit protects us from meteors. There are about 60 more such items than this that we know about. There may be many, many more than that. And they conspire together to suggest that if it's up to chance, it's enormously surprising that there's even one Earth-like planet in our universe, much less two or three. Conclusions on mindlessness, the design and inanimate nature, the design and animate nature, the insufficient probability in thousands, millions, billions, trillions of universes, and the fact that minds can construct order that would never happen by chance. Point two, a universe with a mind behind it. We turn now to eternality. According to scientism, the universe must somehow be eternal, and that's what you get from Carl Sagan and his opening statement in his PBS series, Cosmos. The cosmos is all that is, or ever was, or ever will be. But the history of cosmology in the past century has been that of increasingly frantic attempts to avoid a beginning in the face of evidence that we live in a universe with a beginning. The trick here for scientism is that if the universe hasn't always been, where did it come from? What caused it? Isn't that something supernatural, etc.? And they typically seek to solve that by having the universe having always been in some sense or another. Cosmology in the past century, as Hugh Ross has suggested in his statement about the continually more frantic attempt to have an eternal universe in the face of evidence that our universe had a beginning. In the 19th century and early 20th century, the standard model for our universe, particularly from atheists, was an eternal static universe. That had to be replaced by an expanding universe, as evidence developed from looking at the galaxies that our universe is spreading out. And so we moved to expanding universe models. And after World War II, one of these, the steady-state universe, postulated an eternal universe, though expanding, though with stars running down in it, in which matter popped into existence by some natural law that created matter, presumably out of what? Energy, something of the sort. But where could that come from? That got shot down with further work on the quasars and counting objects and showing that we do in fact live in a universe that was much hotter earlier in its history than it is now. George Gamow proposed a one-bounce Big Bang in which the universe had always existed, a rather uninteresting place early on, just a diffuse hydrogen gas, but gradually that gas coalesced and finally bounced at the Big Bang some billions of years ago and has been expanding since then, and the gas has then been making galaxies and star clusters and stars and planets and people and all of that since, and it will wipe out eventually as all of the energy becomes unavailable. Well, problems with a bounce developed there and have undercut both the one-bounce Big Bang and the much more popular oscillating Big Bang, which you see favored by Sagan in his Cosmos and Asimov in his various writings, with evidence that our universe is expanding in such a way that it doesn't look like it's going to collapse again, and that a collapsing universe would likely not bounce but would pull itself into a black hole. The upshot's been that the evidence has settled on a no-bounce Big Bang of some sort, and the question now is whether that no-bounce Big Bang came into existence at the Big Bang, a theistic-type explanation, or whether that no-bounce Big Bang is just a bubble which formed in a big, eternal, static universe. It has even been suggested by one of the major Stephen Hawking, one of the major cosmologists, that We live into a popping into existence without a cause, Big Bang. But that's a huge problem for science and for scientism even, to abandon causality at that particular point. Conclusions on eternality? It looks like what is eternal is not confined to this universe. It's beyond this universe. That what is eternal has the characteristics of mind. That what is eternal must be an adequate cause for the universe. And that, not confined to this universe, characteristics of mind, adequate cause for the universe, sounds very much like the God of the Bible. We come to our last problem that we're looking at here, and that's locality. Materialism naturally favors local interaction of particles, what we might call bumping. Even Newton's gravitational field back in the early 1700s was initially viewed with great suspicion. It sounded too airy-fairy to the materialists of the time. But it eventually came to be seen as a local interaction of the particle with the force field of Newton's gravity and then later of electromagnetism and such. Quantum phenomena, however, put some pressure on this particular sort of view by suggesting instantaneous interaction at great distances. This is what the whole Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen problem has dealt with. It shows up, first of all, in the quantum phenomena that is quite widely known, what is called the two-slit experiment. One builds a device with two slits in it and has a light source on one side of this screen. And so light will pass through the two slits, and then you have a screen on the opposite side, and you look at the pattern you get there. And what you find out is you get an interference pattern, which suggests a somewhat wave-like characteristic to light. As you turn down the intensity of your light, you eventually get it low enough that only one quantum of light is passing from the source through the screen with the slits to the other screen where it is recorded. And the question arises, what slit does the particle pass through that you're still getting these interference effects? Does the quantum interfere with itself? How does it know when you close one of the slits? It somehow seems to know, because you lose that interference pattern when you close one of the slits, even though only one quantum of light is crossing the whole thing at one time before another one starts. More recently, we have had Bell's theorem, where he pointed out that if quantum phenomena are real, then the universe is not local. It's characterized by phenomena that occur simultaneously in several different locations. Alan Aspect's experiment was designed to try and test Bell's theorem, and he basically showed that measuring particle spin of two particles that have decayed from something apparent particle, that their spins are correlated, and these particle spins somehow show instantaneous knowledge of what the other particle spin is at large distances. Very strange result here. There too we have a result then that goes against what one would expect from scientism, materialism, etc. It seems to suggest some omnipresence of some sort. Not sure exactly how to characterize what it pictures there. But we see these things in conclusion then. Of our first thing, prediction, Laplace's program has collapsed. Continuity, Darwinism is inadequate to explain the phenomena. Mindlessness does not explain the known design in the universe. Eternality, the universe looks like it has a beginning. Locality, quantum phenomena are non-local. We have a designed universe that looks like it is structured to point beyond itself. Perhaps it is unpredictable to remind humans of their limitations. discontinuous to show divine intervention, planned to show a mind behind it, finite to point to the infinite beyond it, non-local to point to the omnipresent God. Is this the end of scientism? Well, the universe does look theistic. We'll have to see where all of that goes.